Good evening.
Good evening.
Wonderful to be here. There's something I'm a little superstitious about, which is kind of not in character because I was originally trained as a scientist, so you know superstitions don't go over too big in the world of science, and so don't take it very seriously what I'm about to say. But Gil Fronsdal says, you know, when you're on retreat, that whatever happens in retreat was supposed to happen. And, you know, sometimes some very difficult things happen. And when that comes up in a Dharma situation, it's usually because you need to go there. Of course, in real life, sometimes some really terrible things happen. So this doesn't apply. The superstition doesn't apply to really terrible things in real life. But I did prepare my talk this afternoon, and I put it on a thumb drive. And since I don't have a, you know, I've moved out of my house and don't have anything to print, so I took it to be printed, and lo and behold, there was nothing on the thumb drive. So here we are. And my topic, what I really want to get across to you tonight is the absolutely central role of happiness in the Buddhist teaching and on our path to liberation. And I'd like to actually talk about two very, rather complex teachings of the Buddha. Complex in the sense that there are quite a few steps. And the way they intersect and help each other. So the first is the one that Rich referred to earlier of liberative dependent arising. And these are the 12 factors that the Buddha described that are the conditions that the practitioner puts in place that lead us all the way to complete liberation and the knowledge of liberation. So I'll briefly review that. And then I'll talk about another teaching, which is the Buddha's teaching on mindfulness of breathing. And in that one, there are 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, and you'll see that there are some overlaps in these two teachings. So the first, liberative dependent arising, the very first condition is suffering, dukkha. And it's kind of amazing that the path to freedom begins, the doorway to this whole path that we're on towards liberation begins with being with our own dukkha. Sometimes dukkha is translated as suffering, sometimes as unsatisfactoriness, sometimes as stress. But it's the first noble truth. It's the truth of our existence that there's nothing in the conditioned world that is going to bring us ultimate happiness because it's all going to disappear. Everything is impermanent. And so the path begins with having a really honest relationship with our own suffering or our own difficulties. And when we start to learn how to respond in more skillful ways to the difficulties in our life, rather than being reactive, having the mindfulness to see what's coming up and stepping back for just a moment and finding a more skillful, wiser response to whatever that difficulty we're being presented with. So we start doing this, that sets the condition that allows the next factor to blossom. And that one is faith, or confidence. So we see that, looking back on our path, that as we respond more skillfully, for example, someone gives us, you know, a truckload of anger, and instead of responding back with another dump truck of anger, we don't take it on. We don't, it doesn't, you know, we have the wisdom to know this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. And we have the compassion to see that that person who's delivering so much anger in this direction, they're obviously suffering. So what could be the compassionate response to that? And the more we find wise ways of dealing with uncomfortable situations in our life, the more confidence we have that, yeah, this is a worthwhile path. I'm good with less suffering. Sign me up. And then confidence, in turn, gives rise to gladness. We're glad that we have a path. Personally, I am immensely grateful for this path. And that that gladness just brightens our life. The Pali word is pamoja. And that arises organically out of this confidence. And the confidence is not just the confidence in the Dharma, but it's also the confidence in ourselves as practitioners, as wayfarers on this path. Gladness gives rise to joy, piti. And we explored this a little bit in the meditation this morning. As I'm sure all of you have experienced, even when you were children, the joy that comes with being fully present for something. You know, you're walking down the street and your mind is not full of all the da-da-da-da-da-da, and, you know, so there's a little bit of space for clarity, and you see a dewdrop on a leaf and it's sparkling. And joy just floods in. So this is the kind of the joy that arises from gladness. It also arises from tranquility, because it's also one of the characteristics of absorption, deep absorption in meditation. So the mind getting very, very concentrated. But it's a physical thrill. And actually, with all of these mind states, there's a whole spectrum of intensity for each one of these positive mind states. So the joy can be, you know, very tender and soft, or it can be, you know, completely thrilling and blowing away. But because it's such a thrill, the joy, it needs to be tempered. And so what tempers joy is what the factor that arises next organically is calm or tranquility in this liberative dependent arising scheme. And then tranquility gives rise to happiness, sukha. Sukha, which is the opposite of dukkha. And so the happiness is really born from calm. And it has a quality of being spacious, imperturbable, quiet, profound, sublime. And I believe that this happiness is our birthright as humans. It's always there, and we have only to, you know, part the clouds of the active mind for it to appear. And then it's happiness in this scheme that gives rise to samadhi, which is usually translated into English as concentration. But it's also, I think, more aptly translated as unification. And unification is already a quality that characterizes sukha. So much of our lives, as we go about things, we're fragmented. And this fragmentation is really a source of suffering for all of us. And so what comes together in this happiness is already a sense of unity, of unification, that we're okay with things as they are. There's a deep contentment, and we're not struggling with anything anymore. And it's this unification from the pleasure of happiness or sukha that is the overriding quality that gives rise to a deep, deep state of meditation, which is samadhi. And then as the progression goes on, samadhi is what allows us to see clearly. And the clear seeing is seeing the truth of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness, and of not self. And from that, very naturally, comes disenchantment. We fall out of love with the magic show that we've been seduced by our whole lives. And then dispassion, viraga, where we're not hooked into it anymore. The dispassion is like, you know, we're not going after stuff or you know, pushing away other things. We've seen through it. We've seen that it's not going to bring us the real deal in terms of happiness. And then it's the dispassion that gives rise to awakening and the knowledge of awakening. So you can see that in this scheme, we've got confidence, which is a positive mind state. We've got gladness that's born of that, which is another lovely mind state. Joy, which is wonderful. Tranquility, which is extremely pleasurable. And sukha, happiness, which is kind of the epitome of quiet, sustained well-being. And I was going to go into the factors of awakening, but after that, in the factors of awakening comes equanimity. So that's even more blissful. The Buddha describes his teaching sometimes as very simple. He says, I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha. And so, as I said to begin with, you know, we have to get the dukkha part first to really see the unsatisfactoriness of what we're tend to go after. And then we embark on a path of ever-increasing well-being. And the Buddha also describes complete awakening, nibbana, or nirvana in Sanskrit, as the ultimate happiness. So there's a whole spectrum of happiness as well in these teachings. I don't know if this is true or not, but it's often said that the Eskimos have many, many different words for snow because they have so many different kinds of snow in their environment. Well, the snow of Buddhism is happiness. There's like, for example, the There's a word, there are at least a dozen words in Pali that are translated into English as delight. There's a dozen flavors of delight alone. So this is these teachings are really, really springing out of and developing very, very pleasurable, deep, happy mind states. So what I'd like to now share with you for this talk is some of what I learned last week on mindfulness of breathing from the Venerable Anālaya. And this is the Anapanasati Sutta. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya, Majjhima 118. And this is a series of 16 steps that the Buddha describes for how to practice mindfulness of breathing. And we did the first six in our guided meditation tonight. And this mindfulness of breathing is quite something because it is the one meditation technique that we know the Buddha himself practiced. He was practicing mindfulness of breathing before he was enlightened. He did many, many years as a wandering ascetic with self-mortification. But he had a real interest in mindfulness of breathing. And at one point, he had this memory of when he was a little boy, and it was the harvest time, and everybody was having a festival, and he was sitting under this apple blossom tree, and he entered into a deep state of meditation, just as children sometimes do. Even American children do this as well. And he was just filled with joy. And he realized, after doing all these austerities for 6 years or so, that this joy was wholesome. And that the path of austerity, of mortifying the body to somehow be free of it, and was not the right path. So the right path, he realized, was one of wholesome pleasure. And with that, the story goes that he was given rice pudding and in milk, and he stopped starving himself and began practicing the middle way, which is neither mortifying the body nor overindulging in sensual pleasure. So joy as what motivated him, wholesome joy, to start practicing in the way that ultimately led him to his awakening. And if you, there are very few references in the Pali Canon, which is a huge corpus of literature, to actual meditation instructions, but this particular sutta is one. And Venerable Anālaya kept telling us this was the Buddha's favorite. This is what he was actually doing. And so there are four tetrads in these 16 steps, four steps in each one. And they correspond to the four foundations of mindfulness, the four satipatthanas. The first one being the body, the second tetrad being feeling tones, recognizing pleasure, pleasant and unpleasant. The third one, the mind. And the fourth one is called dhammas or dharmas. And in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is Majjhima Nikaya number 10, there are many different kinds of collections of things that one can practice. And in the Anapanasati Sutta, it's reduced down to four major ones. So the mindfulness of breathing instructions fulfill the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And they also fulfill the seven factors of awakening. So as we experimented with together this evening, it begins by bringing awareness to the breath. But as Analia taught us, before we even get to starting with mindfulness of breathing, there's all these preliminaries that are good to take care of, like seclusion. You know, leaving our cares and our worries and all that outside the door. And just saying, okay, I'm just going to be here tonight. And then straightening the mind to be really in the present moment. And, you know, if we find ourselves in the past or the future, well, you know, we come back. Making conscious our deepest intention, an altruistic intention of why we're doing this practice. It's not just for us, it's for all beings. And also establishing a meditation posture that we can maintain for whatever period we're going to be sitting in. If you want to really calm the mind, it's very useful to sit without moving one iota. So this is not easy if you're a beginner, so don't lay this on yourself if you're just starting out. But after you've been practicing for a while, it's really, really helpful to have the discipline that, okay, I'm going to sit for 30 minutes now, and I'm not even going to open my eyes or even like move my hand just to, you know, like get a little bit more comfortable here, you know, just tiny microscopic movements. No, just be still bodily. It's a powerful, powerful thing to do. So Anapanasati scheme, that's the mindfulness of breathing scheme, begins by recognizing if the breath is long or short. And it's a little bit, it was to me kind of counterintuitive that it starts with long and then moves to short as something a bit more deep. I think the reason for this is that when we have, we start with a deep breath and then we have these long breaths. And as the body and the mind start to get calm, the breath becomes shorter. And it may take the same amount of time in the cycle, but those gaps following the in-breath and the gap following the out-breath get longer, so that the breath itself, the actual movement of the breath, is shorter. And one of the reasons for this, I think, is because the mind is calming down. And as you may know, the brain is a huge consumer of oxygen. And so with less mental activity, there's less need for oxygen. And so we're just fine with a shorter breath. And so the shorter breath is kind of a good sign that we're on the right path. So those are the first two steps, knowing the long breath and knowing the short breath. And then I might also say, back to the preliminaries when we talk about seclusion, leaving our cares and so forth outside, we also leave the hindrances, or the hindrances are in abeyance. So the hindrances are what the Buddha taught as those qualities that keep us from being able to fully engage in the path. So the first one is sense desire. And the second is aversion or anger. So those are sort of like two opposites. So when we're not lusting after an ice cream anymore, or furious with our neighbor for such and such, that just kind of settles out. There's two hindrances gone, temporarily anyway. And then the next is sloth and torpor. So we're not, you know, like conking out in our meditation, which we tend to do if we're avoiding something or we can't, you know, sometimes it's because you're genuinely tired and you didn't have enough sleep, but sometimes it's kind of a an escape technique. So sloth and torpor is no longer present. And then restlessness and worry, that's a big one. The worry, you know, the worry we left outside the door, but the restlessness and worry is kind of what keeps the thinking mind going on and on. When you start to get settled, even the restlessness and worry subsides temporarily. And then the fifth one of the hindrances is doubt. So you don't have any doubt about the path that you're on. You know that this is a path that works for you. And you also have, you're not poisoned by self-doubt. So that drops away. So as this practice evolves, to really go fully into the depth of mindfulness of breathing, the hindrances are in abeyance to begin with. But this may take years, so you know, don't worry about it if it's not happening right away. You need a lot of patience for this practice. A lot. I am speaking from experience. It may take decades. It may take lifetimes. I mean, who knows, you know? All we can do is the best we can do, you know? So the first two were actually bringing mindfulness to the focus of our breathing. And then in the third step, the breathing we put in the periphery and we really focus on our mindfulness on the body as a whole and letting the breathing illuminate the body for us, how to be aware of the whole body. You may even be able to feel the breath going into your cells, you know, and the cells kind of being woken up by the energy of that and the oxygen. And that is a practice, that third step is a practice you can do for many years. You don't have to go any farther than that to make a huge amount of progress. When the Buddha died, his disciples, some of them were already enlightened, so they were fine with him dying, but not everybody was fully enlightened, and there were many disciples who were distraught. And they said to Ananda, who was his close attendant, who's going to be our teacher now that the Blessed One has passed away? And Ananda said, mindfulness of the body. So let that sink in. If you don't have a Buddha to teach you, you have mindfulness of the body. Good enough. So that one, that's only the third step, and you can stay for that. You can stay with that for the, you know, the rest of your practice, you'll be fine. Then the next and final step of the first tetrad is breathing in, calming bodily formations. Breathing out, calming bodily formations. And I'll just give you a little aside. When As a Dharma teacher, I decided to undertake a master's degree in Buddhist studies. I actually wanted to do a PhD, but my professor said, no, don't worry. A master's will be plenty. I think it's because I was so old, you know. But my motivation was, as a teacher, I wanted to be able to tell you if I'm diverging from what we know of what the Buddha may have actually taught. And if I diverge, I want to tell you why. I'll just give you an example in the Vipassana tradition that many of us practice. You'll hear a lot of Dharma teachers talk about the two truths, you know, the relative truth and the absolute truth. This doesn't appear anywhere in the Pali Canon. This is a much, much later creation. It's only something that probably came up in Burma, you know, in the 20th century. So you can go through the whole Pali Canon, you won't hear the Buddha talking about the two truths. Anyway, that's an aside. But what I'm wanting to say for how I guided you in the guided meditation, I didn't faithfully reproduce the exact English translations of the Pali teachings. So all these steps say, I experience, the literal Pali, because the Pali is, the verbs are conjugated, and so you know it's the first person. So so the teachings say, for example, breathing in, I calm mental formations. But since this whole practice that depends on letting go of ideas of self, the I is not particularly helpful for us as practitioners. It's superfluous. So the way I'm teaching it is not exactly the way it was recorded from what the Buddha said. I'm just using the gerund experiencing. So breathing in, experiencing, calming the body. You always really have to, if you want to know what the Buddha was talking about, you have to go back and look at the Pali. Like I said before, with 12 different words for delight, you don't know which. Sometimes delight means something negative, like delighting in sensual pleasures, and sometimes it means something very positive. And so if you don't know which kind of delight he was talking about, you don't know. So this first part, focused on the body, begins with the breath, and then fully experiencing the body, and then calming the body. And this physical calm then opens the door for the next tetrad, which is based on feeling tones, vedana. And the very first one in this is breathing in, experiencing joy. So it's like once you've got the body in a pretty calm place, the joy is going to come. And you just you keep the mindfulness of the rhythm of the breath always in the periphery, but as you go through these 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, the fifth one is breathing in, experiencing joy. And you do this as a training. So you actually, encourage the arising of joy or the perception of joy. But the breathing is still there in the background, like, the theme that is always present. And the next one, breathing in, experiencing happiness. Breathing out, experiencing happiness. Sukha. So the joy subsides, and this contentment takes over. And joy may not always be available to us. I think I said this before. But contentment is. The one thing that has really struck me from the Buddhist teachings, my youngest sister died of ALS. And it was a terrible thing. She suffered for 5 years, and she had a beautiful death, but she really worked at it. And I remember sharing with her this teaching of the Buddha. He went to visit a householder who was dying and who was a very devoted lay disciple. And, you know, he was in a lot of pain. And the Buddha asks him, how is the pain? Is it getting better? And he says, no, Master, it's getting worse. And it's, you know, the head is exploding and it feels like somebody's ripping my guts out. So the Buddha said to him, and he asked, please give me a teaching to help me at this point in my life. And the Buddha says to him, the body may be afflicted, but the mind need not be afflicted. So this is kind of amazing, you know, that somebody could be in a very difficult physical state and have the mind be contented. You know, this is okay. This is the way it is. It's got to be okay because that's what's happening. And my sister, who was a Christian, got that and was able to put it into practice. And there are many famous Buddhists you can read stories about who also were able to have a very peaceful death, even though there was a lot of physical pain. So that's this contentment of sukha. It's we don't need things to be different than they are. Whatever it is, it is. And we're ready to be present for that. But what's interesting about this second tetrad in mindfulness of breathing is that it starts out with joy and then happiness. And so the invitation of the Buddha is to really tap into these pleasurable mind states. And then, this is really surprising to me, the third one in this is breathing in, experiencing mental activity, breathing out, experiencing mental activity, like thoughts. So, you know, we tend to think maybe thoughts are the enemy and we should get rid of them. But the analogy that Venerable Anallo used for this was a mother taking her children to the park to play, and she's sitting on the bench and watching the kids. And so it's like, you know, we're sitting on the bench of our mindfulness and we're watching the kids, which are our thoughts, you know, they're playing around, but we're not playing. They just, you know, the thoughts come up and they go away and we're not latching onto them. And so, you know, we can see the mind, we can see these thoughts come up, but it doesn't perturb us in any way because we're not invested in them. We're not playing the game. So here we are in this tetrad of feelings, and we notice thoughts coming up, and I think what we're invited to notice here is something like equanimity. that we see these thoughts come and then we're aware of them, and we, you know, then come back into our breathing. And then the fourth one is breathing in, calming the mind, breathing out, calming the mind. So remember that the first tetrad ended with calming the body. The second one ends with calming the mind. So then, you know, you really invite the mind to find this deep tranquility. And so tranquility is one of these mind states that actually has a very important physical bodily dimension and a mental dimension. And so we need to, if we want real tranquility, we need to have the body calm and the mind calm. And then we're into another one of these very pleasurable mind states. This feeling of calm, of deep calm, is, I get goosebumps just telling you about it. I mean, it's just phenomenal to be so at peace with who we are and what our life is. And the peace comes from mindfulness. It all comes from mindfulness. Mindfulness in Pali is sati, and it's like our best friend. You know, at one of the preliminaries for this practice was having sati, mindfulness, being the predominant quality of the mind. So imagine when your mind is really just nothing but awareness. It's a beautiful thing. It's open. It's receptive, it's clear, and it's the doorway to freedom. And it's one of the, when I did a 3-month retreat at the Forest Refuge, and one of the really strong lessons I took away from that was that there's nothing, absolutely nothing, that is not worthy of our mindfulness. Mindfulness is always the teacher. And that's how, in the very first stage of the liberative dependent arising, of having a wise response to our suffering, we're not going to have that wise response if we don't first of all have the mindfulness to see what's going on. So the mindfulness is really what gets us to all of these beautiful mind states. So we fill the mind with mindfulness, and so the end of the first tetrad is this wonderful, pleasurable tranquility, and that then gives rise to the third tetrad of mindfulness of the mind, where we really start to actually see the mind in its pristine state, not full of thoughts, but just, you know, our consciousness, if you like. Or so breathing in, experiencing the mind. Breathing out, experiencing the mind. And so this is the mind that is aware, that is receptive, that is clear. And then the next one is breathing in, gladdening the mind. Breathing out, gladdening the mind. So in the first teaching on the liberative dependent arising, we had gladness as the third, coming out of confidence. So this like an early stage of positive mind states leading to joy and happiness. And here, in this one, where it says gladdening the mind, the gladness is pamuja in the other one, and everywhere else in the Pali Canon. But in this particular instance of the mindfulness of breathing sequence, it in the Pali it's abhi pamuja, abhi as in abhidharma, Abhi meaning high or perfect or anyway, it's the ultimate gladness. And apparently, this term doesn't exist anywhere else in the canon. It's unique to this particular teaching. But so this is a gladness that's actually beyond the first one and beyond the joy and beyond the happiness, gladdening the mind. But it's an active process of, you know, opening the doors so the gladdening the mind can happen. Oops, I'm talking too much. I just looked at the time. Okay, I'll finish up. Is that okay? Got a few more minutes? Okay, thank you. So out of gladdening the mind comes concentrating the mind. Concentrating the mind is samadhi. So here are the mind states that we put in place so that we can actually concentrate. We've got, you know, gladness and joy and happiness and gladdening the mind. And that's in the mindfulness of breathing sutta, that's where samadhi arises. And then the last one of this tetrad is liberating the mind. And this means liberating the mind from ideas of self. So once we have this unification of samadhi, the idea of the small self that we're always so hung up on starts to drop away. And then the last tetrad of mindfulness of breathing is breathing in, contemplating, so we're not experiencing anymore, but we're now contemplating impermanence, and let's see, there's one, contemplating impermanence, and then contemplating dispassion, and then contemplating cessation, so we let all these things come to a natural, organic end. And the very last one is contemplating letting go, relinquishing. So I will stop there. I apologize for going on a bit long. Do you want to have a little Q&A? Or, yeah? Okay. Maybe before we do that, I'd like to. I'm a terrible singer. My daughter's an opera singer, and I just can't sing worth beans. But I'd like to do a kind of call and response with you, and then we can. If you want to stay, we can stay for questions. So I'll say it, and then you say it back. All things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away.
They arise and they pass away.
To live in harmony with this truth.
To live in harmony with this truth.
Brings great happiness.
Brings great happiness.
All things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away.
They arise and they pass away.
To live in harmony with this truth.
To live in harmony with this truth.
Brings great happiness.
Brings great happiness.
So, questions?
Please
use the...
it was the first jhana that joy arises, and that was what the Buddha experienced when he was a young
yes.
boy.
Yeah. Thank you.
I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, Meg. Meg, over here. Yeah, I had a question about when you, I think in the class, you also described samadhi as collectiveness.
Yes.
Because collectiveness to me is, concentration seems to be at odds with open awareness and choiceless awareness. Because when I think of concentration, I think of like a concentrated metta or a concentrated mudita. Mm-hmm. So the collectiveness makes it, you're collecting yourself for open awareness.
Well said.
Okay.
So this is a two-horse chariot. It's vipassana and samatha. So vipassana is insight meditation, where we practice receptive awareness. And samatha is concentration practice, so it includes the jhanas, as you were saying. But it also includes tranquility and concentration. And so there are two kinds of concentration. One is a really, really strong focus to the exclusion of everything else.
That would be the samatha, correct?
Samatha is bigger than that. That's one flavor of samatha. So if you're going to do jhana practice, you need this very, very focused concentration that leaves other things out. But there's another kind of concentration which is wider, and it's what you can do simultaneously with vipassana, with insight meditation, receptive awareness. So if you go to the mindfulness of breathing teaching, you get to concentrating the mind. That's part of this open awareness, is getting more concentrated. So it's really like the mindfulness helps the concentration, and the concentration helps the mindfulness. And we're not going to go into the story of the jhana wars. It's not one or the other. The Buddha didn't teach that, you know, we don't need concentration, we only need mindfulness. He taught that we need both, and that they help us go in the right direction together.
So just to recap, and that's why I always struggle with the first tetrad or triad. The first three seem to be passive awareness, and then the last seems to be like a doing.
There's actually at some point the doer has to get out of the way. But what surprised me about exploring these meditations with Venerable Anallo was that it was kind of like multitasking, and that there was some element of doing, however subtle, that was part of it, in some very deliberate way, you go from one instruction to the next through all 16 steps, and you can do it as a progression, and that's how it works best. But it's also possible, as you're doing it, let's say I'm in gladdening the mind, for example, and all of a sudden I get a pain in my side, then I would go back to relaxing bodily formations, calming bodily formations, for example. So it's okay to play around with where you go in these 16 steps.
So those 16 steps do include samatha and vipassana.
That's right.
So,
yes.
Okay. That's where my hang up is. So I always thought it was just the one. But thank you.
I'm going to miss you. Yeah. I had to go through a bit of grief when, in leaving here, but I'm okay with it now, but yeah, it's been wonderful to be a part of this community. I thank you so much for your welcome and encouragement.